You are listening to the podcast of Providence Church in Austin, Texas. We hope this message raises your affections for Jesus and helps you live out the gospel in everyday life.
Well, some of you don't know me. Those of you that do know me, you may be shocked by this confession. I thought of it when Kaysen was doing the confession. Here it is. I'm not a perfect dad. I know. Don't listen to what my kids say. No matter what they say, trust me, I am not a perfect dad. And in particular, my weakness probably has to do with my understanding of time. So like when I tell my kids I'm going to do something or be somewhere in a certain place or time, I just mean, you know, generally speaking, like in the ballpark, I'll do that and I'll be there kind of like when that happens. That's when that's going to happen, is when it happens. That's what I mean. And that's super hard for kids who are very exacting and remember every single word you say and hold you to it. Especially for my youngest, Holden. He is a black and white kind of kid. Recently, I was to pick him up from school. Now, he loves for me to pick him up from school because I don't get to do that very often. But he loves when dad picks him up from school. So on this day, I was going to pick him up. It was going to be after chess club, which is like an hour after school gets out. And in typical fashion, you know, I was home, I was reading the mail, and I kind of forgot what time it was and what I had said I would do. And I have a helper named Debbie who says, "Hey, aren't you picking up Holden?" And, "Oh, yeah." So I go, "Well, okay, I'm late." He had gotten out early. And so this is after everybody's gone home from school. There's just a few kids out there. He's out early, 15 minutes early. I'm a little bit late. To him, that felt like hours because he's out there by himself. And he's just pacing back and forth. He doesn't know what he should do. He doesn't know if he's okay, if he's done something wrong. He assumes probably dad has done it again, and he's frustrated with me. And eventually, he just decides he's going to take the adventure and walk home by himself. And I'm pulling up toward the school right as he's coming across the crosswalk. And I can see in his face he's hurt. He's a little scared. He's real frustrated. All at me. And so I pull in, and he gets in the car, and I'm like, "Hey, buddy." You know, that wasn't going to cut it. And I could see it on his face, you know, and I was like, "I'm late, aren't I?" He's like, "You know, Dad, I've been here for hours." And, you know, so I put my hand on his leg. We talk it through. It's okay. Here's what struck me in that moment was that even though I'm the problem, like I'm the cause of all of his suffering in that moment, even though that's true, do you know what he wanted more than anything else in his suffering? To be with me. There's something just hardwired in kids that when things fall apart, when they're unsure, when there's no stability, when they're scared, when they're frustrated, they just want to get to mom or dad. Because there's something in a kid that thinks, if I can just get there, even if nothing around me changes, it'll be okay. I'll be with mom and dad. It made me think of when Jesus talked about how we're supposed to have childlike faith. You know, he doesn't say we should have childlike maturity, childlike understanding, childlike wisdom or ability. He says we should have childlike faith. And I'm sure that means lots of things, but in relation to this story, I think pretty fundamentally it means this. A child's faith is such that if they can just be with dad or mom, everything will be okay. And I think that's what Jesus is saying he wants for us. To have the kind of faith that would trust that if we could just have God, everything else would be okay. We've been talking in our study of Romans, the last few weeks, we've been talking about change, our desire to change, the process of, you know, the biblical process called sanctification. Primarily, we've been talking about how hard it is. That it's just difficult because of sin in us that's waging war against our new and good desires. We've talked about how slow it is, how much sort of intentionality it takes on our part. Change is just really difficult. And now we're coming to Romans 8, which is still in the context of the same discussion, and Paul's going to bring up another thing, yet another obstacle in the process of change. He brings up suffering. And he doesn't just say like, "Hey, suffering's a thing that you might encounter." He's like, "No, actually, suffering for Christians is like a required course. If you're going to major in Christianity, this is a core course, and there's going to be lots of them. Suffering. You will suffer." Before the text that you heard read, here's what it says. Here's what Paul says, verse 16 in Romans 8. If you've got it, open up, because we're going to walk through this text. He says, the Spirit himself bears witness with our spirit that we're children of God. And if children, then heirs. Heirs of God and fellow heirs with Christ, provided, this is how you know that you're a child of God, we suffer with him in order that we may also be glorified with him. We will suffer. We must suffer. And the problem with that is that it's in times of suffering where we get real down. We get discouraged. Those are the times, if we're not careful, that we just want to give up on this whole thing of changing. And so in the rest of this text that you heard read, Paul is, I think, aiming to reorient our lives in such a way that when suffering comes, we not only have the resources to get through it, but we can get through it in a way that we're changed by it, that we're sanctified in the midst of it. And here's the orientation that has to happen if that's going to be the case. We have to be oriented to God as our Father. That's the import of the whole text. Back to verse 16. The Spirit bears witness with our spirit that we are children of God. That's the context of what's going on here. And if we're children, then we're heirs, fellow heirs with Christ. And so you see that at the beginning of this text, that the Spirit orients us, reminds us, convinces us that who we are, we're children of God. And then you're going to see that text or that theme come up throughout the rest of the chapter. You'll see it in verse 19. He talks about how creation is waiting for the sons of God to be revealed, their glory to be revealed. He goes on to talk about how we are longing for our adoption as sons. He talks about how we're the first, how Jesus is the firstborn among many brothers, that there's a family, that we're part of what we're trying to understand here is that we're brothers of Jesus and children of God. And it's just all throughout. What the Spirit is trying to do is to convince us, to make real to us that God is our Father. And here's why. Because you will suffer. You must suffer. And the only way you get through it and the only way you're changed by it is if you run to God in it. The way that a kid runs to mom and dad because he knows everything will be okay. All right, so that's the point of the text. When I finish talking, what God wants you to feel and be compelled to do is to run to him as Father. And some of you are less ready than that for that than others. Well, what do we find when we run to God? Well, a lot. The first is we find a father's perspective. You know, when my kids are, when they're anxious, when they're afraid, it's almost always the case that some circumstance has become inordinately large in their life, right? Something has happened, or they anticipate that something's going to happen, and it is so big to them. It feels so heavy that this one thing might have the potential to sink their entire life. And so as their dad, when that happens, the first thing I want for them is to just get some perspective, to be able to kind of remove themselves from the immediacy of this thing and see a bigger picture. And that's what Paul is saying. That's what he wants for us, is to have some perspective. Now, there's kind of a typical way that parents do this, which is not what Paul is saying. You know, like when my kids talk about being hungry, they'll use the word starving sometimes, and I'll be like, no. Our friends in Guatemala, remember those kids? They're starving. You're not starving. You just haven't eaten in 15 minutes. That's what's going on here. I want them to have that kind of perspective, right? There is something valuable in that. It's like, okay, I should be thankful for what I have. But that's not quite what Paul is doing. That actually is a little bit self-focused and shallow. What Paul's saying is, now I'm not comparing your suffering to the relative suffering of others. I'm saying that when you go to God, who is your Father, you find some perspective that is much, much deeper than that. You find that it in my suffering or in the kids in Guatemala suffering, whatever it is, we find this perspective that says all suffering is temporary and worth it. Our suffering is not the final word, and the final word is so glorious and so good that it makes whatever we're encountering here seem, as Paul would say, like a light and momentary affliction. This is what he says in verse 18. For I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worth comparing with the glory that is to be revealed to us. This word consider means to think it through. to reflect on it, to turn it over, to add it up and come to some conclusion. And so what Paul is saying is, he's like, look, I've been where you are. I have suffered. I mean, you can read Paul's resume of suffering. It's pretty intense. And so Paul's saying, I've been there. I've been in that moment where I wondered, is this worth it? I mean, should I just throw in the towel? He's saying, I've asked all the hard questions. I have begged God to change this one thing in my life, and he wouldn't do it. He said, no, my grace is sufficient for you. And I'm like, I don't want grace. I want this thing to change. I've been there. And he says, and I've come to a conclusion. I've learned something through my suffering and in my questions. And here's what I've learned. The sufferings of this present time are not worth comparing. Not even close to the glory that will be revealed to us. And then he gives us his reasoning. He walks us through it. Verse 19. For the creation waits with eager longing for the revealing of the sons of God. For the creation was subjected to futility, not willingly, but because of him who subjected it, in hope that the creation itself will be set free from its bondage to decay and obtain the freedom of the glory of the children of God. For we know that the whole creation has been groaning together in the pains of childbirth until now. And not only the creation, but we ourselves who have the first fruits of the Spirit groan inwardly as we wait eagerly for adoption as sons, the redemption of our bodies. And so what he's saying is like, look, just the witness of creation and the witness of your own soul, if you'll listen to it, is that suffering is just part of the story that we're in. It's just reality. When Paul thinks about this world and when he thinks about life in this world, the word that comes to mind here in the text is groaning. And it's a really strong word. I mean, it has to do with pain and death. I mean, the picture he uses is one of the groaning of a woman in childbirth. And you have to remember, in that time, it was much more common for women to die in childbirth. This is a very strong word. And Paul is saying that's what life in this world is like. Creation is groaning in that way. And it's an interesting little allusion to Genesis 3, because that's where the whole pain and childbearing thing started, right? The world was perfect. Sin entered the world and ruined it. And part of the consequences of it is that there would be pain and childbearing. And in that same text, we see that creation itself is cursed. And as Paul says it here, it's subjected to futility. It's in the bondage of corruption. And not only creation, but us too. We fell in Genesis 3, and so all of humanity is groaning. Even Christians, Paul is saying, you're not exempt from this. We who have the first fruits of the Spirit, we are also groaning inwardly. But that's not the whole story. The groans of creation are groans of childbirth, which means what? There's new life coming. And as we groan, he says a couple of times, we wait eagerly. Something is coming. Our suffering is going somewhere. It's taking us somewhere. And so suffering is part of the story that we live in, but it is not the last word in that story. Look what he says. God subjected creation to futility. How? Why? In hope. In hope that it would be set free from its bondage to corruption. You see, God has put hardwired into the world this direction, a telos, a destination. It's going somewhere. It has a glorious end. This is not, we're not spinning through time aimlessly, like we're in an indie film or something, you know, like nothing ever resolves. No, we are in an epic saga with a glorious ending. Look at this ending. The creation waits with eager longing for the revealing of the sons of God. That's us. And we wait eagerly for our adoption as sons, for the redemption of our bodies. New, resurrected, glorious bodies in a new, renewed earth. That's where we're headed. That's where our suffering is taking us. In the beginning, before corruption and decay We were made to care for creation, to rule over it. It was a good setup. It was awesome. God would come down and walk with Adam in the cool of the day in the Garden of Eden. The world was as it should be. And Eden was kind of this prototype. Everything was just right there. And Adam and Eve's job, and our job would be eventually, to expand Eden into the rest of the world, to make the whole world like Eden, so that God could come down on every square inch of the world and walk in the cool of day with people from every tongue and tribe and nation. That's what the world was supposed to be. And when you see what we have now, you see the degree to which sin has corrupted and ruined creation and the design of creation and our design to rule over it. The ground was cursed. They were exiled from the garden. And in one fell swoop, all of creation and mankind went from glory to groaning. And that's been the story ever since. Groaning. But it's not the end of the story. The witness of creation is that it is longing for something. It's longing for the glory of Eden to be restored, and for the radiance and the glory of the sons and daughters of God to be restored, and for things to be as they were meant to be. That's where our suffering and our groaning is taking us. Holden, I'm probably going to tell a lot of stories about Holden because this is a father sermon. One of the things I love about Holden is his desire and longing to travel, to see the world. There was a time in his life where the two places he really wanted to go were China and New Mexico. And what was great about that is he didn't know which one would be further or closer. You know, they were all the same to him. He sees a picture of a place and he begins to imagine all the things that are there and that he could explore, and he wants to go there. And so, you know, you put on like a National Geographic film or something for him, he loves it. He's all into it. He loves it. But then I started to realize that I'm not going to be able to like meet the demands of this desire. Like, I don't have the money or the time to go all of the places that he wants to go. We were talking about this one night at dinner, and I was trying to break the news to him. I was like, hey, buddy, I love that you want to go there, but probably not. Like, I don't see that happening. Maybe if you make a bunch of money and have some time, maybe your brother will do that. I don't know. And, you know, I could see the disappointment kind of setting in on his face, and I started to think through it, and I was like, hey, listen, here's the good news, buddy. Do you realize that this isn't the only chance you have to go to all those places? He was like, what? I was like, yeah. I mean, you've got, whatever, 50, 70, 80 years here, and you can see some of those places, and it'd be great. But even if if we did have the time and the money, and all you did was travel, you still wouldn't see them all. Like, you can't fulfill that longing, no matter what here. But guess what? This doesn't go away. It gets renewed. The whole creation is longing to be renewed. And I asked him, like, do you realize how awesome the Grand Canyon is going to be in the new earth compared to what it is now? This is just a taste. It's just a glimpse of what it will be. And we started imagining together about how awesome the Great Wall of China will be, and how awesome Big Ben will be, and how awesome all the things that we want to see will be in the new heavens, in the new earth. But there's a problem with that. How will we take in such glory? Now, see, God's got this covered. We're going to have resurrected bodies. And just as the Grand Canyon we know now is nothing compared to the Grand Canyon that will be, you and I are nothing compared to what we will be. One person said this week, you know, what do we have, like 5 senses right now? Take away one of your senses. And the gap between 4 and 5 is just amazing. Like, the ability to take in the world and enjoy it with 5 senses is so much larger than with 4. And then he said, but in our resurrected bodies, I don't know, we'll have like 1,000 senses. Because we'll have to be able to take in the glory of the world that is to come, we will have to be up to glory, right? We will have to be glorious enough to enjoy it and inhabit it and rule it. And that's the kind of stuff Holden and I start dreaming about. Ruling over this place together, walking every square inch of it because we have so much time and we don't need any money. In your groaning, whatever it is, whatever your unfulfilled longing is, God is whispering to your heart today. He's saying, your salvation is not in this world. Don't be fooled by that.
set your things on the world to come. Set your heart on the world to come, on God himself. Here's the key principle. Verse 24, the perspective boils down to this. For in this hope we were saved. This same hope, this is what I just described, that's what we were saved for. Now hope that is seen is not hope. For who hopes for what he sees? But if we hope for what we do not see, we wait for it with patience. Perspective allows us to stop freaking out, to stop melting down as if this world is our only chance. And it helps us just to wait with patience because our best is yet to come. Biblical hope is a life-shaping certainty about the future. It is knowing the end of the story and being so confident in it that it completely changes the way that you live in your current chapter. That's what hope is. It's not like, oh, I hope this happens. It's like, I know this is going to happen, and it infuses my present life with all kinds of joy and meaning. And that's what Paul wants us to have here. He's saying, suffering is just, it's a condition of just being in this world. It's a thing. You can't escape it. But despair is something different. Despair is a condition of being attached to the things of this world, of thinking that this world is all you have. Hope is certainty that there is a world to come. And when you know the end of the story, it changes everything about how you live now. But it's more than that. It's not just like God is at the end waiting for us. It's not like if you watch The Amazing Race, God's not the host of the show at the pit stop at the end, just waiting for you to get there and he can tell you how you did on your own. That's not, no, God enters into the race with us every step. And so when we come to the Father, we not only get perspective, we get his presence with us every step. Holden came downstairs one night and he walked into our bedroom and I said, hey, what's up? And he said, well, I don't understand what I'm going to say and you're not going to understand what I'm going to say. Deep thoughts. I was like, well, it's midnight. Let's give me a shot. What is it? And he said, I don't feel right. I was like, all right, well, what do you mean? He's like, well, I don't know. I just don't feel right. And I don't know why. I'm like, well, you're right. I don't understand what you're trying to say. But haven't you ever felt like that? Like, in your suffering, haven't you ever come to a point where you've thought, something doesn't feel right. I have a hard time even articulating what's going wrong in my life, but I can kind of point at stuff, but there's something really deep that just doesn't feel right. Sometimes our suffering is like that. It's that quality, and we're not even able to articulate it. Well, Holden was coming to us with that, even though he knew we wouldn't understand it, because, well, you know, when you're with mom and dad, everything's going to be okay. He thought if anybody's going to be able to understand it, it's going to be mom and dad. And if anybody's going to be able to help me in this, it's going to be mom and dad. And so he came to us. I told him, you know, you can pray. And he's like, well, I don't even know what to pray. How do you pray for something that you don't even know is there, what it is? And so he wanted us to pray for him because he didn't have words to pray. And so, look, we did our best to understand him and pray for him. But here's what I want you to see. We have a Father who helps us in this way, understands us and helps us and even prays for us. And he does it perfectly. Look at verse 26. Here's how God's present with us, not just with us, but in us. Likewise, the Spirit helps us in our weakness. For we don't know what to pray for as we ought, but the Spirit himself intercedes for us with groanings too deep for words. And he who searches hearts knows what is the mind of the Spirit, because the Spirit intercedes for the saints according to the will of God. And so this little connector word likewise is taking us back to verse 15 and 16 where we started, where the Spirit's job was to testify with our spirit, to bear witness to us that we're children of God. And he's saying, likewise, Just as the Spirit speaks to you about being a child of God, the Spirit also speaks for you to God when you don't know what to say as his child. He's with you every step of the way. In our weakness, we do not know what to pray for as we ought. Amen. Like, there are times when we just don't know what to say. We can't put words to it. That's what happened to Holden that one night. And I finally just said to him, hey, bud, here's the good news. All those deep feelings that you have and those longings, those emotions, do you know what God does with that? The Holy Spirit who lives in you takes all of that stuff, that inarticulate stuff, and articulates it to God in the form of prayers. He turns your groaning into prayer before the Father. There are other times when we do have words to say, maybe too many words. Right? Sometimes our prayers are just a mixed bag. Like, we have these deep longings in our soul, good things, longings for health, companionship, justice, reconciliation, just the energy to like be able to serve other people, all kinds of good desires. And it's reasonable, I think, to ask God to give us those things. But we never know exactly how that should come, right? We never know exactly how God should answer the prayer so that he would receive the most honor and glory. We just know what we want. For example, if I'm sick and I'm saying, God, I'm sick, I want to be well, that's a good thing. I was made to be well, right? But I come to that point where I think, well, I don't know. I don't know what most glorifies God. I don't know if God will be most honored and glorified by healing me or by my perseverance through the sickness. I don't know. I know what I want. I just don't know how God should answer it. And so I'm this mixed bag of things. I have this genuine desire for the world to come, but I have this selfish desire for the world to come now, at least in my life in this particular thing. Right? I'm all about God's will being done as long as it makes sense according to my will. Do you ever fall into that prayer thing? Right? We're just a mixed bag when it comes to this stuff. Well, there's always a core part of us that has that genuine desire. And then there's the other part of us that has that selfish desire. Now, here's what the Spirit does. The Spirit enters into our weakness in this way. And it takes the core desire. It takes the deep longing for Jesus to be exalted and for God's will to be done. And it takes those things and lays out our petitions before God as they ought to come. As they ought to be. Because we don't know how to pray for it as we ought. But the Spirit does. And he's helping us in our weakness. This is such good news. I mean, it means you don't have to know what's going on all the time. You don't have to know what God's doing in every situation. Because the Spirit knows what God is doing. And he will take your longings and intercede for you according to the will of God. You don't have to know exactly what to say. My goodness, you don't even have to have words at all at times. Because the Spirit has words. The Spirit knows what to say. You have a Father who searches your heart and discerns. Prayer's not a formula. It's not like I say this and this and this and then I get that. And if I mess this up, then that's going to get messed up. It's not like that. Prayer is a cry of the heart. You know how, if you're a mom especially, your child has about 19 different cries. And you know which cry means they're really hurt, and which cry is they want you to think they're hurt, and which cry is they're hungry, and which cry is they're sleepy, and which cry is they had a toy taken away. You know all the various cries of your kid, right? God knows you in that way. He knows all the various cries of your heart. He searches it out. He discerns it. And the Spirit says, yes, this is what this person really needs, really wants. God, do this. He's with us. When you suffer, run to God. Call out to him in prayer and trust that he hears you and knows how to answer you according to his will for your good. It's not just that everything here is meaningless. You know, there's this world to come and it's great and everything here is just sort of getting through it till then. That's not at all the case. Because God is present with us, everything here matters immensely. And so we not only get perspective, we not only get his presence, we get this world of providence opened up to us. Not the church, but God's providence. Which just means his sovereignty, his ability, his control over everything and to work everything together according to his plans. Look at verse 28. And we know that for those who love God, all things work together for good for those who are called according to his purpose. This is a really famous verse, a very oft-quoted verse. And it's really amazing if you think about what's being said here. God is working all things together for good. Everything, every thought and deed in the history of the world and the history to come, God is working it all together for good. Now, imagine if the world and creation was glass, all made out of glass. And what sin did was to shatter that glass into trillions upon trillions of pieces. What this verse is saying is that the story of redemption is that in ways you can't even see, God is picking up every piece of broken glass and putting together a mosaic that is going to take your breath away. You can't see it from where you are, just like you can't see the planet from where you are because you're on it, right? But there will be a day in which we are lifted, when we'll be able to see, we'll be able to look back and see all that God has done. All of the brokenness and the pain and the groaning is all of the sudden beautiful. We won't be able to take, we'll need resurrected bodies just to even take in the glory of that moment. Isn't it amazing what this verse is saying? It's saying, take the pain you feel, take the loss you've experienced, your loneliness, your groaning, take it all to God, because he is so good, so wise, so sovereign, that he uses all of that to make something beautiful. It doesn't change your suffering. It just changes you in the midst of your suffering to know that he's doing that. It's an amazing verse. Here's the problem. Has anybody ever quoted that verse to you when you were suffering? You're in pain or grief, and they're like, hey, honey, it's okay. God is working out all things together for the good of those who love him. Pow, you know, just that's what you want to do in that moment. Why is this amazing verse not that encouraging in the moment of suffering? I've been thinking about this all week because I hate it when people quote this verse at me. But here it is. Paul's quoting it at me, and I'm supposed to like it. I think it's because when we kind of just rip it out of context in that moment, it feels like our suffering is being belittled. It feels like what's being said is, you shouldn't feel this pain. You shouldn't feel this grief, you know, because God's making it beautiful. Well, that's not what Paul's saying. Paul's saying it's real. Groaning is real. I mean, Jesus groaned, sighed, mourned. And so Paul, weep and wail and mourn. But don't let it define you because it's not the final word. Take it all to God and see what he'll do with it. Trust him. Trust him with it is what he's saying. All right, the difficult thing about providence is we want to be in the know. Providence is this reality that God is at work in ways we can't see to accomplish things that we can't even imagine. And we get sort of left out of that equation, and we don't like that. We want to be in the know. We want to have control. We want to understand our environment and kind of be able to control all the outcomes that are going on around us. That's what makes us feel secure and maybe even valuable. And so our desire to be in control leads us to sort of set our heart on the things of this world. We begin to kind of put our hope in things that we can see, right? So if I want to be in control of my security, I begin to set my hope on my money, right? If I want to be in control of feeling lovable or feeling like I'm worth something, I want to set my heart on maybe a relationship that I want or that I have, put my hope in it to give me that sense of worthiness, and on and on and on, right? We get attached to the things of this world to satisfy these deep longings that only God can satisfy. providence is to trust in providence is to let go of all the things that we see. Not to dismiss them, but just to not put our hope in them, not set our hearts on them. And so I think it's worth asking the question, how do you know if you're attached to the things of the world? How do you know if you've set your heart on things in this world? And from this text, I think the answer is this. The sign that you have set your hope on things that are seen is that there is despair in your life. Not suffering. Everybody suffers. But when the suffering comes, when those things that you set your heart on are taken away, when a loved one is taken away, when a job is taken away, when your money is taken away, when your reputation is taken away, when, you know, when your power is taken away. If those things are taken away and you've plummet to despair, like you want to give up, like that one thing might sink your entire life. If that's how you feel, you've set your heart on that thing. You've put your hope in that, which is seen and not, which is unseen. And hope in things that is seen is not hope at all. And so there is this sense for us, I think, that we need to train ourselves to cultivate a longing for the world to come. You're not going to just drift into detaching yourself from the things of this world. This is the part of sanctification that requires some intentionality. And so I want to just mention to you that the spiritual disciplines come in this context. By spiritual disciplines, I mean things like reading the Bible, praying, going to church, resting, solitude, fasting, giving, all kinds of things. Those aren't like benchmarks of Christianity. Those aren't like, this is how I please God and I earn favor with Him. No, these are ways to train ourselves to detach from this world and to set our hope on the world to come and the God who rules it. For example, if money is your thing, if you set your heart on money, this is why tithing is such a good discipline, right? It's not just because, oh man, the church needs our money, which is true. But for you, it means, okay, I am systematically parting with some significant percentage of my money. I'm saying, I'm going to let go of this and trust God to provide for me. Trust that God will take care of me. And as I do that, I become the kind of person who's just not attached to the stuff of this world. Solitude, Sabbath rest even. To take a day and not work. And really not work. Like not have your computer on, and all that, but just to rest and play. Do you know how much that would drive some of you crazy? Because your whole sense of like being worth something is tied up in your productivity, your work. But just to step back and rest would be to say, you know what? The world's going to be okay if I don't work today. I don't run this place. I'm not in charge of it. Its success, its ability to keep going has nothing to do with me. I could stop existing now and this world will be fine because I'm not in charge of it. And Sabbath rest just allows me to like take that in, to detach from needing to run things and control outcomes. Prayer does the same thing, allows you to back up and not try to manipulate situations, but learn how to trust God who's providentially in control of them. Fasting, same thing. Some of you are so attached to food and drink as a source of comfort and pleasure, and if you would just maybe withdraw from those things now and then, you might learn to detach from them, to not set your heart on them, and to trust in God. He's got food that you don't know about, food that's unseen. All right, when we run to the Father, we get perspective that changes everything. We get His presence. We get led into this world of divine providence. And the last thing, and very briefly, Paul says here, is all of this is rooted in the Father's promise to us. Verse 29, for those whom He foreknew, He also predestined to be conformed to the image of His Son, in order that He might be the firstborn among many brothers. And those whom He predestined, He also called, and those whom He called, He also justified, and those whom He justified, He also glorified. And some of you, when you hear the word predestined, you just want to get this like theological radar goes off, and you want to have debates. And let me just tell you, that's not at all what Paul's doing here. He's not trying to explain some theological thing. He's actually trying to give you comfort and assure you of God's promise. All he's saying is that God guarantees your change, your sanctification. He's put His own name on it. It's not rooted in your circumstances. This, your change, your glory that is to come was planned way before time even began. God, in other words, God's promises are not like mine. They're not like ballpark in general, give or take. They're exact. Before time began, he knew you, chose you, set his love on you. And what he began with, who he began with, is who he ends up with. Those whom he predestined, he called, and those he called, he justified. And those he justified, he glorified. It's written in the past tense. That's how sure it is. That's the kind of promise we have from our Father. It is done. Stop fretting. Stop worrying. What you want to be, you will be, and even more, because God will see to it. It may not be on your time and in your way, but even better, on his time and in his way. God promises to change us. Do you want to change? I mean, really, really change. Deep down. Are you tired of the ruts that you've dug in your life? Are you going through something that is beating you down, that makes you want to give up? If so, I've got one thing to say. Run to God. Run to God like a kid runs to his dad, because if he can get him, if he can have him, everything will be okay.
Thanks for listening to the podcast of Providence Church. For more resources and info, visit us online at www.providenceaustin.com.